The topic for our forum this evening is resurgent Islam and U.S. world politics. Can you say just a few words about the topic and about the way in which we can proceed? This is a forum, and that means, as Larry said in the announcements today, that this is a public place for public discussion. John is here as a resource person. You are resource people by what you know about Islam and by what we don't know about it, and by what we've learned from the media and all of our other experiences. So John is one of the resource people in this room, and you are the other ones. And so it is a discussion for all of us, and not just a lecture from John to you. One of the reasons we have forums is to keep reminding ourselves that holding is not a resort, but rather is a place for the renewal of the church, primarily through the work and mission of the laity of the church. And so we find often that these forums that we are dealing with difficult issues, but that is why we're here. John Taylor is our resource person, World Council of Churches. The family lives in Geneva now. Maybe you know all this. Their official residency is in England. He's the director of the Division of Dialogue with Living Faiths and Ideologies. John is not a United States citizen, but I do not believe that reduces his value to make observations about us. I think he'll be sensitive to that if we will be open to hear what he has to say. Larry mentioned to me today that at the start of the Vietnam War, there were 12 people in the United States who were acknowledged authorities on Southeast Asia. 12 authorities at the beginning of the war. And a similar question must now be asked, perhaps. How many people in the United States understand Islam? And what might have been prevented if there had been more information here about Southeast Asia? And of course, the implications of the questions are, what do we need to know this day about Islam? I visited with John briefly today. He made a comment about humor, and that is that he finds us laughing at some rather inappropriate humor, that if it were directed in the same way to Jews or to other Christians or to a great many other peoples around the world, we would be offended by such humor, and we would not laugh at it. In fact, we would probably call people to task for saying such things in our presence. Yet we are comfortable with some anti-Islamic humor today, which John points out is an indication of our present mindset and a way in which maybe we can understand our own reason. I asked John today where there were some examples of resurgent Islam and its effect on United States world politics, since that's our topic. And he said the following. You want some examples? Here are some places where Islam and the Christian faith are in conflict, not as religions, but as representations of their governments, of various governments. The following countries: Iran, Afghanistan, various Palestinian countries, Cyprus, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Sudan, Uganda, Tanzania, the Philippines, parts of Indonesia, parts of Malaysia. And then I just stopped, et cetera. And then I held up my hand and said, I don't think we need any more examples. We are, the whole world, in a way, is in conflict, and a part of it centers so much around the question of Islam and the Christian world. And John pointed out that this conflict was not caused by religion, necessarily, but that religion was a part of the tension-growing process, a part of the ways in which the tensions were intensified. So our topic is resurgent Islam and U.S. world politics, and maybe John would like to make some opening comments to lead us in our discussion, perhaps centering in on Iran, since the death of the Shah is so recently upon us, and 49 United States citizens are still there. And that is of concern to us. However, you would like to center and focus our discussion, or the rest of you would like to shape, please proceed. And I will try to be a moderator for the evening.
Since you give me the first word, I would just say something very brief about this title, Resurgent Islam. Let's be careful about the way we use the word resurgent. Let's not pack that word with too much emotion. Let's perhaps play around with the different words we can use to describe what's happening in the Islamic world. Some of it is, yes, resurgence, even with those sort of threatening echoes that word has. Some of it is spiritual revival. Some of it is a very honest form of reformation, where they are trying to modernize their faith. Some of it is in the spirit of a rather narrow and fanatical type of Islam, but some of it is in the spirit of a very outward-looking, open Islam. Some of it is resurgence, if you like, of traditional powers, including political and clerical powers, but some of it is revival of popular voice and popular spirituality. Some of it is a struggle for social justice and political justice. Some of it is an internal struggle, some of it is an external struggle. Extremely complex, and maybe we'll illustrate some facets of this in response to your questions and comments. It's been suggested that we should start somewhere, and that Iran is so much in our minds that this is a good place to start. On the other hand, let me remind you that as far as the whole of the Islamic world is concerned, Iran is somewhat untypical. It is untypical in terms of the particular religious pedigree of Islam that is there. It is unusual that in Iran, and also in little pockets of North India and pockets elsewhere, there is a group of Muslims called Shi'i who are a little apart from the mainstream of Islamic orthodoxy. One of the features of this Shi'i Islam is that it has always been a political form of Islam. At a time when the mainstream of the Islamic world said it doesn't matter who the caliph is, as long as he's an honest man, the Shi'i group said, no, we must have a caliph, a leader of the Muslim world, who belongs to the family of the Prophet Muhammad. They tried it for a while. The person they wanted was eventually defeated in battle, became a martyr. They had a series of other caliphs or imams who were there, so to speak, in hiding. And then in the end, it didn't work at all. And they developed a doctrine, a sort of messianic doctrine, of waiting for the political come religious leader to come back and to bring justice. And this partly explains what's happened in Iran today. That Iran has gone through a troubled period, a period of the sort of ruthless, monarchical control, not only the family of the present Shah, but the monarchies that went before, with only a very short period of democracy. Incidentally, Iran was the first Islamic country to get a democratic revolution at the beginning of this century. That's sometimes forgotten. And incidentally, it was the clergy who helped that revolution in 1905. But just as the clergy at that point were good in opposition, helping to bring about the revolution, and then, unfortunately, failed to carry their way through. So we are seeing at the moment a very tense situation whereby the clergy, the Islamic clergy, have rediscovered this political thrust, even this messianic thrust. They've brought about a revolution which at the moment of the revolution, I remind you, was an astonishing achievement, a virtually bloodless revolution at the time. And yet, we know that they are now facing all the same sort of difficulties, running very often to the same sort of mistakes that the Shah himself made. Some of the revolution is, if you you like, an Islamic revolution. Some of it is a cultural revolution, whereby they are saying no to the materialism that was prevailing in the economic development programs and the patterns of consumerism and so on that were developing in Iran. Some of it religious, some of it cultural, some of it spiritual, a real challenge against the atheism and the secularism that was there in society. But some of it, the other side of the coin, a rather dangerous form of clericalism, of fanaticism. And this is the very ambiguous situation in Iran today, which is so difficult for us all to understand, whether we're Americans, whether we're Europeans, whether we're Muslims in other parts of the world, looking on at Iran and disturbed by many of the things we see, even though we mustn't forget that as well as those disturbing things, there have been some achievements. But over to you, how do you see it? What do you feel American response should be? To us, a bit outside, it has looked that America had over-identified with the previous regime and is going to find it very hard to find a way of some sort of readjustment if relationships are to be rebuilt with not just the government of Iran, but the people of Iran.
Well, I have a question going back to your earlier presentation, maybe when we get to this, and that was the image that you projected of a historical tolerance, a theme of tolerance in Islam, which I question. I'm not a scholar, but just as a lay person who has read and has been in some Muslim countries, my own empirical observation is that they are a very intolerant people of outside ideas, outside cultures, and even intolerant of one another. I can remember scenes of people throwing rocks at other people in Turkey because they were from the village down the line, not because they were. I just have an image of Islam as being a very intolerant religion, ethic, and so I'm not surprised by what's going on in Iran at the time. It seems to me more like my own experiences in Muslim areas.
It seems to me we are perfectly at liberty to talk about intolerance in Islam if at the same moment we are doing an equally self-critical study about intolerance in the Christian world. I would differentiate between what the teaching of Islam is and what the practice of Islam is, and between the teaching of Christianity and the practice of Christianity. I would be the first to admit that there has been a great deal of intolerance disfiguring both Islamic and Christian history. What I've tried to remind us about is that this isn't the total picture, that the actual teaching of Islam, the actual jurisprudence of Islam, has, to an extraordinary extent, more than any other world religion, by and large, made provision for difference of opinion, accepted minorities or even majorities of other faiths, recognized them, allowed their religious leadership to function, legislated about it, and so on and so forth. Then, of course, you had the rulers like Tamerlane, like Timur, like the Mongols, new converts to Islam, fanatics coming in and spoiling it all, just as in Christian Europe. You had some of the new converts to Christianity in Northern Europe going on the rampage and forcing people to become Christians at the point of a sword, just as there have been ugly scenes in even more recent history of Christians violating other people's religious liberties, right through to the utter blasphemy of the Holocaust. But if you take the practice of Islam, then I agree, there have been many failures. And yet, how many of these are to be directly attributed to religion, and how many more to cultural and political factors, is very much, I think, an open question that has to be researched much more carefully than we sometimes do. Even when you take a conflict, say like the recent conflict in Lebanon between Christians and Muslims, it isn't really a conflict about religion. The violence, the extreme violence, is on both sides, and is done despite the constant appeals to peace by the religious leaders. Unfortunately, the religious leaders are making these appeals too late. They haven't. They too, as religious leaders, haven't been sufficiently practicing what they preached in the past. I think that we've got to be very careful when we talk about Islam in building up a sort of caricature image, this image of Islam spread by the sword, this image of intolerance. It can become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy if we push it too far. Of course, there is as much conservatism in the best sense of the word, there is as much traditionalism in the best sense of the word, and also in some of the worst senses of the word, in Islam as in the Christian world. But there is also a strong thrust of modernism, liberalism, whatever we want to call it, again, both in the good and bad senses. The Islamic world, as numerous as the Christian world in terms of its adherents, or almost as numerous, has room for almost as much diversity. And while it is possible to point to these more enclosed and entrenched situations, don't let us impose that upon the whole. Don't let's forget that a lot of Asian or African Islam has a great deal more social flexibility than Middle Eastern Islam, a lot more intermarriage, a lot more even acceptance of conversion, which is technically against the Islamic law. But I mean, I've been to baptism services in West Africa where the Muslim family comes along to the church and is all present when their son or their daughter is baptized into Christianity. Unthinkable in many parts of the Muslim world, just as it would be unthinkable, presumably, for a good Lutheran family in some parts of Europe to go along service when their son or daughter was being either becoming a Roman Catholic, let alone becoming a Muslim. Yes.
What's the Quran or scripture have in it, and does that affect their political viewpoint? Is it laws, or is it scripture like our Bible, or is it stories and things?
The Quran doesn't have detailed political rules. It doesn't say very much at all about, you know, how to elect a caliph or whether democracy is a good thing or anything like that. There are various basic principles that come through. The idea, for example, of consultation, talking things over, is there in the Quran, is later developed in Islamic political theory, and is, in fact, a very strong democratic principle in the present processes in the Muslim world. And many people in the Muslim world are strongly criticizing the feudal structures and the monarchical structures, and saying that's not what the real Islam was about. The real Islam, going back to the time of the Prophet, was, yes, a prophet, but I mean, he was special. Apart from the Prophet, it was a process of a sort of parliament. It was a process of discussion, and it was a process too of there being some decisions being taken by the religious leadership and other decisions being taken by the political leadership. So there are these very faint models there in the Quran. The Quran also has certain elements of legislation about public law as to what to do with robbers, what to do with murderers, what to do with traitors, and so on and so forth. It has a lot of private law, how to regulate marriage or divorce, inheritance, and so on. But as it has a lot, compared with the great mass of legal literature that follows, it's relatively little. But the Quran does have some of these requirements, for example, are very, to our mind, harsh punishments for murder, for adultery, and so on. Incidentally, so does the Old Testament have jolly harsh punishments. And it's interesting that Islamic history, on the whole, has toned these punishments down. It has laid down all sorts of requirements to say, well, you can only impose this punishment if the following conditions are fulfilled. Some of it actually is very modern by our standards. you know, they take into account all the psychological and the social factors. You even get the point where, for example, this business of amputation for theft, they say this only can take place in a situation of a just society. It can only take place where there is no need for robbery, where nobody is suffering in an unjust society and, in a sense, being victimized. Nobody is themselves a victim of theft by society. It's only in the ideal society where somebody breaks the taboo of property that you can then impose this extreme sanction of amputation. So amputation has not happened in many Islamic societies. The catch today is that Saudi Arabia, in a somewhat self-righteous way, believes that it is an ideal society, believes that it has restored all these ideal Islamic legislation, and therefore we can bring back amputation. And revolutionary Iran has also jumped the gun, rather, in declaring that it has achieved just society, though many Muslims and many others have certain thoughts about that.
John?
Yes?
What is the primary motivation behind, I don't know if you would call Islamic evangelism, or spreading, or is that an offensive question? What's their primary motivation?
It's interesting the word they use for mission or evangelism in Islam. It's the word invitation. And a missionary is an inviter. And this affects the way in which Islam has spread across the world. As I said, it hasn't really been when it's been a powerful political leader forcing people to become Muslims that you've had the success stories. The success stories have come when it's been the preachers, the mystics going around just quietly settling down in an African village or a Southeast Asian port, praying five times a day, impressing people by their spirituality, by their charity, and so on. And that has started the popular ingrowth to Islam. Perhaps we shouldn't pursue that too far just now, because I think we want to stay a bit on the political wavelength this evening. But I'll come back to it later in the week.
There's motivation of spreading, of
yes.
political expansion?
No, I would say more than anything else, it's a strong evangelistic zeal. It's a feeling that we know very well as Christians, that they have a faith that is a universal faith. This is good news for the whole world. From the word go, it's been for Arabia, for Africa, for Asia, for everyone, for Europe too. And you have that same sort of evangelical fervor in the Muslim that you get in a Christian. Actually, I think this is a very healthy thing. I feel in some ways more at home in dialogue with a missionary-minded Muslim than with some of my good Hindu friends who say, well, of course it doesn't really matter. We all ultimately believe the same thing, don't we? And we believe it in different ways. But, well, that Hindu mentality can be very beautiful, but it can also get a bit wishy-washy. And at least there's that in me which says we're being more honest to each other when we recognize each has a missionary vocation. The big catch is whether we are in our mission projecting ourselves or proclaiming our God. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that Islam at its best is proclaiming its God, proclaiming the God, the one and only God. And that Islam at its best is making that the priority. Unfortunately, Muslim missionaries can fall into the same trap as Christian missionaries, and it can become a more communal type of mission, where they are simply wanting others to be as we are, where they are simply wanting to expand the community, sometimes with a good sense of hospitality and openness, sometimes with, let's face it, a sort of expansionist and impatient and intolerant approach to others. I would say that the places where Islam has been especially intolerant to other cultures, especially intolerant to particular African tribes or particular Southeast Asian tribes, or particular groups of Hindus, that is where Islam has failed. And the places where Islam has failed is where Islam has been more two-way hospitable, where Islam has adapted itself to the local cultural features. And this, of course, is what is happening today, and this is one reason why also in our foreign policies, whether we're American or whether we're European, we're becoming more and more conscious of the way in which many African countries are beginning to associate their nationalism or part of their nationalism with being part of the Islamic world. That there are local parts of Africa that are feeling themselves intensely Muslim. There are parts of countries in Africa, parts of Nigeria, parts of Ethiopia, parts of Chad and so on, that are feeling themselves strongly Islamic. But they also have this sense of worldwide solidarity. Some of them are looking for another option. They're looking not only for alignment with Russia or America plus Europe, they're saying, well, a plague on both of those, we would like a third way, and although they may be very critical, say, of Gaddafi's third way, they are beginning to wonder whether there couldn't be some other way of third world solidarity around a universal faith like Islam. And this is something we have to take very seriously. The increasing diplomatic weight and economic weight of something like the Islamic Foreign Ministers Conference, largely made up of third world nations. Not only Arab, I remind you, although the Arabs may be, for the moment, paying the administrative costs and so on, but a lot of the policy is being made in Nigeria or Indonesia or elsewhere. Sorry, it's rather straying on. There's another question up here and one down here.
I just wondered your feelings on the relationship between the amount of oil dollars going into the Islamic country, if this is any direct result of the insurgency in the Muslim faith, or if it's totally unrelated. Would the Muslims have rallied even without the oil money?
Yes, I think there's certainly a new factor in the scene has been the new spending power of the Muslim world. We are noticing what we call the resurgence of Islam more, because now, in the way that Christian churches and Christian hospitals used to be the only concrete buildings or brick-built buildings across great areas of Africa and Asia, now, on the other side of the road, there is a brick-built mosque or a brick-built Muslim clinic or whatever. And some of this is there because of what we call oil wealth. I think actually we have to push that thing a little bit further. Everybody talking about oil wealth and so on reminds me uncomfortably that the Theological Education Fund of the worldwide ecumenical movement was very largely financed by oil money through the Rockefellers. So, you know, it depends just where the oil money is coming from, whether it's coming from the consumers or whether it's coming from the middlemen. Oil money has affected the expansion of the Christian world and has affected the spending power of Christian missionaries in the same way that it's affected the spending power of Muslim missionaries. I would want to remember that in a lot of places, these powerful Islamic missionary movements were in fact active 20, 30, 40 years ago, when they were still without a penny to spend. A lot of these movements which are coming up now into the forefront and worrying us all very deeply, whether it be the Iranian revolutionary Muslim clergy or whether it be things like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and so on, these are not depending upon oil dollars for their popular appeal or for their political programs or their humanitarian projects or their missionary expansionism or whatever. They are getting maybe a new visibility as a result of the money,
But the founders of these movements and the popular appeal of these movements, and in many senses, the perseverance, even in face of persecution by these movements, persecution by Nasser, persecution by Sadat, persecution by the Shah, etc., etc., these movements are long-standing, and they are part of a very deep cultural revolution whereby Muslims are questioning, and let's face it too, many Christians are questioning, not least in the Third World, whether the spiritual values and the spiritual priorities are not just being bulldozed away by certain forms of economic and political development. Many churches are asking themselves as to whether there hasn't been too much investment in the bricks and mortar, too much investment in the prestige projects, and so on. And many Muslims have asked themselves as to whether their countries really ought to be developing in a direction sometimes of crude materialism, using the new wealth that has poured into a country like Iran, for example, not to produce the universal literacy or the universal health care that they could have produced, and that countries like Libya, admittedly with a much smaller population, have produced, that some of the Gulf states have produced, that what Iran was doing was producing a society with an ever-widening income gap. Tehran was one of the most unpleasant cities to visit, in my estimation, where the rich were getting ever richer with the most vulgar, conspicuous consumption, though who are we to talk in Europe or America about that? But Iran had somehow got caught in a trap of, I think, distorted values, and there has been a popular uprising to contest this. Not all of the popular uprising is well conceived, not all of it is just. Some of it is as corrupt, if you like, as what it's trying to replace. But there has been a very challenging backlash, if you like, of people saying, well, put it in Jesus' words, if you like, man should not live by bread alone. What's happening to our life of prayer? What's happening to our family loyalties? What's happening to our requirements of chastity? What's happening to our idea of community? With some of the individualism, in the bad sense, as well as the good sense, that was creeping in. Maybe it was more of the bad individualism that was coming in than the good individualism. Maybe the blessings that are there with material wealth and material progress, and who are we to knock that when we enjoy it so much? Maybe those blessings of material wealth were being so unevenly distributed, so unjustly distributed, that at the end of the day some people said, we'd be better without it. Let's close down our oil production. We're not interested in just our oil dollars if our oil dollars are going to corrupt our society. So oil wealth has at some points opened wonderful new opportunities in these countries, but at other points it has opened up terrible dangers of a golden cow. And let me remind you, idolatry is always the great sin in Islam. Idolatry not just in the sense of the graven image, but idolatry in the sense of putting anything between you and God. Idolatry in the sense of making any other false absolute. Idolatry in the sense of any sort of self-sufficiency. What Islam is all about is what the word itself means, submission to God, being a servant of God, learning a proper dependence upon God, learning a proper dependence among humanity. Now, there is a very beautiful vision in Islam, which we would also claim to have in Christianity. I'm not sure that so far we've lived up to our Christian ideals. I'm certainly not sure that Muslims have lived up to their Muslim ideals. But both peoples are in travail.
And we could use the situation of travail just to tear out each other's eyes, or we could use the situation of travail to find a new form of self, of mutual help.
Larry?
That just answered my question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just learned recently that not too long ago, Iran fed itself, produced enough food to feed itself, plus enough to export. And that the acceptance of the Green Revolution, which has done so much good in Libya, did exactly the opposite, am I right, in Iran. And I'm wondering why that had such a disastrous effect to increase that gap between poverty and wealth.
One of the great problems of Iran, and one of the things that, for example, President Bani Sadr has been particularly emphatic about, is that Iran saw more dramatically than many other countries a tremendous exodus from the country to the towns. Incidentally, this isn't entirely a new thing. This thing has happened right back over centuries and centuries. I won't elaborate this, but one of the most fascinating archaeological things in Iran is to go out into some of the deserts and find under these completely empty deserts there are fantastic underground irrigation canals. Now, those irrigation canals were in fact destroyed centuries ago by the Mongols. But the Iranian people have been a very gifted agriculturalists. But again and again, either by external aggression or sometimes by internal tensions, they've deserted the land, the deserts have encroached, etc., etc. They've funneled more and more into the cities. And particularly when the oil wealth poured in, it seemed that all the money was being spent in the cities. All the fruits of the oil were to be enjoyed in the cities, but apart from a few token projects, apart from a few forced conscripts who were sent out to teach in the villages or whatever, there was no real concerted attempt to spread the revolution across the country. And even in those very, very fertile areas, for example, along the Caspian coast, there was still the most abject poverty among the peasantry. Just as, of course, there was abject poverty among the industrial workers in Tehran. It was, I'm afraid, a society with, I think, quite unacceptable standards of social justice, one where there was no real mobilization of farm workers, of industrial workers, whatever. I hope I don't appear in saying this that I'm a sort of rabid red or anything like that. But I think that all of us believe that there are decent conditions for organized labor in a developing country. And unfortunately, under the Shah, even the most elementary union rights and so on were being denied. And people were despairing, people were giving up. What was the point of staying on the land in circumstances like that, when maybe they could cut in on some slick commercial deal in the town and buy their food from outside? Now, this has been one of the absurdities of Iran, that a country that could produce splendid rice, could draw excellent fish from the Caspian and from the Gulf, could produce in some of the uplands around Kermanshah and so on excellent wheat supplies, could even tame the desert, and for the first time had the resources to start rebuilding all those irrigation schemes that had once been there. They were frittering their money away on lavish consumer consumption. And that has been the tremendous economic crunch with the present revolution, where they are trying to shift away from urban and pseudo-industrial expansion. I say pseudo-industrial because people used to go and say, we make our own cars. But of course they were 95% produced in Britain. There was a huge deal with Chrysler UK, and they were produced as Pecan cars in Iran, but they were only just screwed together in Iran. At this moment in time, the priority is not projects like that. so much as getting the whole economy of the country, including the agricultural economy, on a proper basis. And I think this is one of the things that the new government has got a surer instinct about than the old government. Whether they'll achieve it or not, I don't know, because they're certainly making a mess of a lot of the things that could help them forward in their revolution. There's a question at the back. What scripts you like to know? Okay, people who ask the question. Sorry, excuse me.
My question is just in terms of how you see what's happening now in Iran, in terms of is the situation normalizing at all politically, and can you perceive of it as Islam nation in the best sense of the word, in terms of that happening, in terms of justice?
Again, I remind you that the Iranian situation is very special. Because it's Shiite, because it's this heterodox group of Islam, they do attach more importance than other Muslim countries to the clergy. And so to some extent, it is more normal for Iran to have clergy in a position of political power. One of the things that went wrong with the original democratic constitution that came in 1905 was that although they wrote into the constitution that laws should be vetted by the clergy, they never applied it. Now we have a situation whereby the clergy have got almost too much power. I think we need to get back to if we're going to talk of normalcy, we need some sort of balance between, if you like, a clerical advice, because this, I think, is what Islamic clergy, maybe Christian clergy, are best at, not being rulers, but as being advisors. When they're not consulted at all, then a tremendous opportunity is lost, not least in making a government truly popular. Because what clergy do in these countries, in these Middle Eastern countries, perhaps in some Christian countries too, is to provide a very genuine link between the ordinary person and the government. The clergy are in fact very much closer to the common people than the technocrats and many of the politicians. And the clergy have, in Iran, led a truly popular revolution. So, normalcy returning, it's too soon to say. At least, for the time being, we can see that element in Iranian culture which gave a voice to the clergy, that element is back again, and that's good. I believe it can be partially good, providing it is balanced with that other element which ought to be there in any good Islamic society, which is this consultative element, this conferring, this democratic component. In the case of Iran, again and again, that has got ruined by a monarchy. And this again goes right back into history. History repeats itself over and over again here. I happen to do my doctoral thesis in the area of 14th and 15th century political thought in Islam. It's very strange to see history repeating itself. I did that study long before I knew what was brewing at the moment. But I didn't say I'm now being wise after the event, but right through the ages there has been this attempt to balance the religious input with, if you like, what we would call the secular input or the democratic input. And again, there has been an autocrat, sometimes from the outside, sometimes imposed from the outside. Let me remind you, that is the accusation that is made about the Americans and the Europeans with the now deceased Shah, that they overthrew him in a popular uprising under Mossadegh in 1953, but he was brought back by the CIA, etc., etc. That is the way they perceive it. And they say, we didn't ever choose the Shah, he was foisted upon us. So, normalcy could return if we get this balance between democratic power and clerical power. It's very difficult to see it happening soon, all sorts of imponderables, how long Khomeini will last. We now at least got the imponderable of how long the Shah will last out of the way. Poor man. We don't know how long Khomeini will last. We don't know how long the clergy will last. And the new possibility that is there is that the outside intervention will not be perhaps Europe and America imposing another model, some puppet prince from the House of Pahlavi, incidentally a dynasty that was never a real dynasty, but one was just sort of dreamt up in recent years. The father of the Shah was an upstart sergeant in the army. That's very snobbish of me, excuse me. but perhaps that was a good democratic image. He could have been a democratic leader, but he didn't. He went the wrong road. No, what I'm trying to say is that the new possibility is that it could be from the north, from Russia. Russia has always eyed Iran. And if a new overall controlling force comes in to destroy the north, to destroy the possibility that we're achieving normalcy, it could well be that of some Soviet-supported autocracy of a different sort.
I guess the second part of my question, if I can continue, is about the hostages in terms of, to me it was a hopeful sign that when Wright started having neurological symptoms that he was released. So somehow it doesn't seem to me that there are flaming radical students that are running on strictly emotional level that have these hostages, and yet the newscasting that we often get is, you know, that things are out of control there. It seems to me that it might be safer for the hostages than we might imagine.
I'm horrified by the whole hostage episode. I must say that I see it in a slightly different light from what it's been sometimes portrayed in the American sensitivities, though I understand why the Americans have portrayed it like this. I don't see it. Let me complete my sentence. I don't want you to misunderstand me. I don't see it essentially as a violent act in the sense of it being a murderous act. I see it essentially as an attempt, though an incredibly misguided attempt and an incredibly cruel attempt, at what we may call non-violent protest. Let's just survey what's happened in recent history and realize that when people have tried to make a point or declare a war, in many, many instances it has been in terms of straightforward physical destruction. And we know that in the whole revolutionary history of the 20th century, there have been relatively few people who've gone the route of Gandhi, which was to say non-violent protest. Let's not forget, however, that when Gandhi talked about non-violent protest, the British thought it was jolly violent. I think that maybe in the perspective of history, we'll see that people have said, well, it was significant that those Iranian students who could simply have dynamited the American embassy with everybody in it and created a violent protest, that they chose what they conceive as a non-violent protest. Now, I don't for a moment condone it. I think it's utterly deplorable. I am much more concerned and much more disgusted that the Iranian government, etc., has apparently condoned this. I think students taking the law into their own hands in a revolutionary situation and doing what is technically a non-violent act in terms of not actually killing people off. That's one thing. But I think a government condoning this continual violation of diplomatic law is very sick and very serious. On the other hand, maybe we're being asked to see, we're being challenged to see what the real ethics of, for example, of diplomatic immunity are. We all think that diplomatic immunity is very important, but is it really healthy that all of us, all the Western European powers, the Eastern Bloc, etc., etc., and certainly, I'm quite sure, countries like Iran, have been misusing diplomatic immunity for all sorts of other purposes. And for example, very specifically, the misuse, they say, of using diplomatic channels for CIA agencies to be training things like the SAVAK secret police. They believe that that was an abuse of diplomatic privilege that has had to be exposed. I think they're using the wrong way to expose it. But this is how they are doing it. Now, how on earth do we react in a situation like this? We've seen all sorts of different reactions. We've seen on the church side, the Methodist Church, for example, in the United States, having a day of penitence on Ash Wednesday for some of the sufferings that, in terms of starting with the beam in our own eye, they, as American Christians, felt had been done to the Iranian people. We've seen some Muslims deeply disturbed, deeply critical of what Iran is doing. Iran is almost totally isolated, not only in the world community, but in the Islamic world community, in following this route that they've chosen on the hostages. I think one of the things that perplexes us most about it all is the time that it's all taking. And one of the things that disgusts us most is the time that it's all taking. At this point, I think we have to say, well, you know, how do we perceive time? Muslims, for example, look at our prison systems in Western Europe and in North America, and they say, but it's unthinkable to shut people away in prisons for 10 years or 20 years or whatever. We give them a quick lashing and that's it. But we think it's intolerable to lock people away like this. On the other hand, we think it's intolerable to keep people locked away as hostages. So, you know, we've got very different culture systems, senses of time scale clashing at a point like this. They say, well, we've lived like hostages for generations under the Shah. It's a phony argument, I know, but somehow this is one of those places where individuals are having to bear the guilt, bear the pain that has been caused communally. But I think the pain has been caused communally from both sides. I think that the guilt situation and the responsibility situation that is dramatized by the hostage incidents is not just the guilt of the Iranian people, not just the guilt of the American people, not just the guilt of the British people with all their dabblings in Iranian politics, but of the whole world community, so many of whom have been opportunists, so many of whom have been unscrupulous in their oil politics, in their Cold War politics, etc., etc.
Back here is questions. Go ahead.
I perceive a strange dichotomy in Islam. On the one hand, throughout all their history, they have displayed a remarkable tolerance to other religious and social groups in the Middle Ages, modern times. And yet, in every country that in Islam, I see another group that receives short shrift in the Quran and short shrift in each society in terms of economic rights. And speaking of women, how do you feel about women in Islam?
Again, the situation varies greatly from parts of the Muslim world to other parts. As I said to some of you last week, if you look at it in a historical perspective, Islam brought a new deal to women. Islam brought, for example, property rights for women. Property rights for women which were often not respected in the Christian world. Napoleonic law, Code Napoleon, didn't allow married women to have property in their own name. And yet, married women in Islam always had property in their own name. Dowries in Islam were not what the woman gave to the man, but what the man gave to the woman. And the woman sat on the capital, and it was there as a sort of security for her marriage. Inheritance rights were laid down very specifically. You couldn't just, as many cultures do, pass on your farm to your eldest son or your three sons and forget your daughters. Your farm has to be divided up, or your property or your mine, whatever, it has to be divided up into specified portions. And the women all have their particular quota admittedly, the court sometimes half a share, even in some instances a quarter share for the female person compared with the male person. But the reason is that the male has more responsibilities, equally legally binding upon him, for the upbringing of children, orphans, all this sort of thing. The apparent oppression of women, and sometimes, of course, it's more than apparent, sometimes it's real oppression of women in the Islamic world, I think again has to be looked at from a total cultural perspective. Very often it's not specifically Islam that is to explain this, it's a more overall cultural ethos in an area. You get parts of West Africa, for example, where Islam is strong, where all the economic power is in the hands of the women, because it's always been that way. And when Islam came along, it didn't change that. These simply were societies where women were bosses. And neither Islam nor Christianity has seriously modified that. You get parts of Southeast Asia, where Islamic law has been considerably changed in order to accommodate the economic role that women have and the very open role that women play in society. As I said earlier, you don't see the veil in Southeast Asia or many parts of Africa, except where a new form of Arabization has come in. On the other hand, in many parts of the Middle Eastern world, you find that the very secluded role that women play applies just as much to Christian women as it does to Muslim women. I suppose you would see more instances of Christian women breaking this down and challenging this, but in the what we may call the feminist movements in many Middle Eastern countries, you find Muslim women and Christian women absolutely united with the same sort of common agenda, trying to overcome male domination, whether it be among Christian men or whether it be among Muslim men. One of the things that we have criticized from the Christian world most strongly has been the legislation about divorce. We have said that it has been much too easy for Muslim men to divorce Muslim women, even though the Muslim woman has been able to hold on to the dowry, even though the Muslim man still has alimony responsibilities and responsibilities towards the children of the marriage and this, that and the other, and so on. On the other hand, most of us in the Christian world have recognized, certainly in recent years, that provision for divorce is a very subtle but also a very important thing to work out in a society. Most Christian societies have moved from a position of absolute refusal of divorce to a modified acceptance of divorce. Most Islamic societies are moving away from a sort of free-for-all for divorce, which was against Islamic principle, back to the real Islamic principles. And the real Islamic principles on divorce are pretty tough. It's very interesting to look at the statistics of some countries that have had reintroduction of Islamic laws about divorce, and the divorce rate has dropped rather than gone up, because the real Islamic law about divorce lays down all sorts of requirements about conciliation courts, about alimony, etc., etc. Similarly, Islamic law lays down very strict requirements about what happens in the case of a plural marriage. One of the main accusations that Christians have made against Muslims is that Muslims have been disrespectful to women because they have allowed plural marriage, a second, a third, or a fourth wife. It's true that in certain societies, notably African societies, this has been, if you like, a loophole in Islamic law, which has been exploited. But let's not forget that it's also exploited because it's a very deeply rooted part of the culture, and many Christian churches in Africa are de facto polygamous societies. The church may not recognize it, but it happens, whether people like it or not. It's a very deep social convention. Many of us would hope that it will change. But what's happened in the Islamic world is that it has been possible to have a plural marriage, But very often, the plural marriage has not taken place. Because when you take your Islamic law really seriously, there are all sorts of provisos. You have a second, third, or fourth wife in certain contexts. For example, looking after orphans. And you only are allowed the second or the third or the fourth wife, providing the other wives agree, providing you can afford to be absolutely equitable economically to all the wives, and providing also, and this I think is the most difficult thing of all, that you are a person of sufficient moral stature to be able to share yourself equally and fairly between your wives. And the argument today, the more people know about psychology and so on, is to say, well, sorry, there just aren't any of those supermen around, so let's settle for one wife. A traditional Islamic society today is a society where monogamy is the pattern. Some Muslim countries like Tunisia, Turkey have made monogamy obligatory, and where it works well, it is, I think, sociologically very similar to what we try to achieve in the Christian world, although we unfortunately have in the Christian world also a lot of, well, perhaps I shouldn't cast value judgments, but we do have in the Christian world a lot of marriage patterns, or in inverted commas, concubinage patterns, which are a long way from what has been the traditional Christian pattern.
I'd like to ask one more question, and that is, for our study in congregations, where, you know, we can read the newspaper and get inflamed about hostages and all of that, are there some resources that we can use on a congregational level that will help us understand? And then if you could just comment on that for just a moment, and then we'll call this over. There are more questions, and we can stay and visit some more. But it you should have the chance to take a jacuzzi before you fall asleep. Yeah.
No, I think
just to briefly on some resources we could use in our parishes.
The resources that I've seen that I think would be most easily accessible to you are, in fact, the resources that have been put together last year and this year by the NCCC USA, because there has been a special study thrust by the National Council of Churches of Christ in the USA, and regardless of what your ecclesiastical sensitivities are about the NCCC, I think that their study program on the Middle East is an honest one, a fair one. It lifts up, for example, the whole thing we haven't got into tonight, but is intensely important, and that is the whole business of how to do justice both to the state of Israel and to the Palestinian people. It lifts up some of these issues of Christian-Muslim dialogue, of Christian-Jewish dialogue, and these materials available from 475 Riverside Drive in New York are geared very much for local congregational use. From what I've heard, these materials have gone very well, but there has been a whole ferment of study going on in American churches. In fact, the explanation why my little introductory book on Islam has appeared in an American edition here is that it was picked up for that study program, and I suppose one reason why I can afford to have a vacation with my family in the States this year is that enough people have bought not quite enough, but encouraged me.